Welcome to Indigenized Connections on Air, a podcast brought to you by the University of Minnesota Extension Center for Community Vitality in the area of leadership and civic engagement, and also by the Minnesota Indigenous Leadership Network, which explores the issues that impact tribal communities and leadership throughout Minnesota. I'm your host, Jason Schlender, and I'm the American Indian Leadership and Civic Engagement Educator. My guest today is from the Catholic area and is a highly respected and sought-out Ojibwe language immersion educator. His innovation, charisma, and approach to Indigenous language immersion pedagogy is truly fascinating. So please welcome Dustin Burnett to the podcast.
All right, Buju, thanks for having me. I feel strange to talk about me in a leadership position. I don't see myself as that still, but I've definitely had a really, really great experience getting to where I am now professionally in the work that I'm doing. MIIN, which you mentioned, is a nonprofit which I'm starting. It's the Midwest Indigenous Immersion Network. The purpose of that nonprofit is to help with facilitation and collaboration between the Ojibwe immersion schools in the region here. Hopefully in the future expanding to help other communities if what we do is actually successful and helpful. But my path to there started as a teenager in Cass Lake, Minnesota. Just a regular Cass Lake kid, I guess, like anybody else, you know. And I lost my mom and kind of turned my whole world upside down and really sent me looking for who I was. You know, I didn't have that guidance anymore, so I wanted to know who I was and what I was about and what all this crazy stuff was about. And I searched everywhere I knew to look, couldn't find anything. And then this guy came into my life through the schools at Cass Lake High School by the name of Sean Farnlander. And really great guy, kind of outlined for me and showed me that I had more options than just the Euro-American Christian-based concepts that I had had in my life to that point. And he really opened the doors for me as to what it was to be an Ojibwe person. Really gave me that sense of identity that I didn't know I was missing. And, you know, he signed me up for college, forged my name on my enrollment papers, amazing. But got me set up in a nice university with a great crew. Who really walked me along towards being an educator. He also got me involved in ceremonies and other community connections. But from that point, moving on after college with my teaching degree, I still was a Cass Lake kid, so I, you know, had a chip on my shoulder and thought the world owed me something and a job would fall into my lap. I didn't need to apply. You know, it was God's gift to man. I just finished college. I was 21. And here, August came and I didn't have a job, but the bills were stacking up. So I took the first job that I saw, and that was teaching kindergarten and first grade immersion at Negane over at Bogunogijic School in Bena, Minnesota. So definitely out of my wheelhouse, but I took it on, and I was very blessed and lucky enough to be paired up with some wonderful first language speakers from Rosemary Dabungi and Leona Wakanabo, Jerry Howard, Steve Jackson, and Marlene Stately. But it was that experience working with those elders and working with other fantastic educators at that school that really started to propel me towards my love for Ojibwe immersion education in our communities. From there, I went on to come over here to the Coudray, where I worked at Wadi Kudadi for 10 years, also in an instructional capacity. And at that point, you know, during that time, just continue to really be blessed enough to make connections with speakers, whether in Mille Lacs or, you know, here in Wisconsin and other professionals working in the same field. And it was through all that and all those experiences over those 13 years in the classroom working at these couple of Ojibwe immersion schools that I was able to start working with the other schools and other communities working on Ojibwe immersion in one capacity or another. And after all this time, you know, we've all definitely seen some holes in what we do. But we're all just so darn busy trying to keep the doors open where we're at and trying to keep the keep the bus going forward, that we don't always have time to deal with our internal issues or our big planning needs. So I decided to take a step back from education from teaching for a while, and try to focus on some of our bigger needs as a language learning community. And for me, the way I'm trying to go about it is, like I said earlier, is to bring the different organizations together, bring them all to the same table, and start to identify how we can kind of take some of the weight off each other's shoulders. You know, kind of how we can share this burden to kind of open up some more time and resources for each individual community, while simultaneously bringing together what we do have to increase the opportunity for all of our students and all of our families and all of our educators who are out there really giving it their all, including all their time, to try to make sure that we have what we need for this Ojibwe revitalization movement.
So you mentioned the Midwest Indigenous Immersion Network.
Correct.
You know, what was the vision for that? Where did the vision come from?
Man, big shout out to our mutual friend, Bobby Tawagijigukwe, Melissa Boyd. So Melissa and Lucia Bonacci, she's a founder of Boog, they contacted me about 3 years ago, and Bobita was applying for a Bush Fellowship, and she said, hey, here's my idea, I'm going to call it MEAN. Here's what it means, Midwest Indigenous Immersion Network. MEAN is an acronym, it means blueberry in Ojibwe. And she kind of outlined some ideas and concepts around, you know, bringing the different schools together, and they said, we want you to be chair of the board. And I said, no. They're like, what? Why not? You know, and I said, because I couldn't imagine sitting in the background and watching someone else do that. I need to do that, you know? But of course, I kept participating, and I started planning and laying stuff out, and I kept contacting the ladies trying to have a follow-up meeting, and they were both too busy, and none of them had time. And here Melissa ended up changing the direction of her fellowship, and MEAN went by the wayside for a couple of years. But, while nobody else was thinking about continuing it, I was planning and thinking and brainstorming and having all these fun ideas of what it could possibly be and how helpful it could be. And then eventually I decided, I needed a break from my classroom, 13 years inside of four walls. And I thought, I'm 34 and I've never done anything but stand inside these four walls. And I think maybe I'd like to poke my head out the rabbit hole and see if there isn't something more I could be doing to be more helpful and more effective for our communities.
So what are the steps, for it? Because you get to the point where you're like, well, okay, I want to do this. I want to pick up this work, this nonprofit, but how do you get, how do you get buy-in? How do you get of the funding?
You tell me. No.
Or do you just go to say, hey, I got this. You guys want to be a part of MEAN? Or?
Kind of. So there are a few steps I went about. Like I said, I've been really lucky to work with most of these organizations over the years, whether as, a curriculum developer or hosting professional development for young teachers, assessing. And I've been able to build relationships with these different organizations, which was a great first start. And this is something that is, like I said, it's all I've done since I was a teenager, or 21 years old, pretty much a kid still. And this is all I know, but it's something I know well. So I felt really confident that I could go after this and hopefully make a positive impact. So the first thing I did was, I did what I guess we all probably do, is I went to my peers, but my mentors, my peer mentors, and I talked to them about it. I ran it by them, called a couple of my family members, talked a lot to my wife, thought I'd meet resistance there. I was hoping she'd hold me back, but she's like, go, which is great, so I got a lot of support from her. But really, it was just reaching out, kind of testing the waters with some of my mentors, seeing if this was something that they might be interested in participating in, those of whom were already in the field. And then once I got some positive feedback from there, along with the excitement I was feeling and taking off and trying it out, I started doing some research on it. And I actually got really lucky. I was finishing up my master's at the College of St. Scholastica in Education, and I had a couple credits left, like four credits, so I worked it into an independent study where I actually went and did academic research on the formations of collaborations and third sector parties working inside of public schools. And it was that research that really helped me to make it even into past this first year. You know, because there are a lot of times where I'd get my head down with, you know, lack of participation, or I'd find discouragement, or, you know, I'd struggle with paying for all this out of pocket to this point, you know, and I could go back to my research and remind myself that, hey, that's not abnormal. It takes time to develop these relationships. In addition to that, we're all stuck on Zoom. None of us could see each other. I couldn't even go and offer tobacco at the time when I was contacting the schools initially because we weren't allowed to go anywhere, you know? So, you know, there's some hurdles in that, but that research was really, really a helpful tool for me to say, hey, this, you know, I know that this is normal. I know some tools to maybe combat it, you know, or to help address these needs. Also did some research on survey development so that I could develop and send out an appropriate survey that would help measure the stakeholders' needs and wants, while simultaneously kind of outlining some of the commonalities that I saw when building this so that I could share that with future funders.
Who funds, not who, but how do you fund a project like this? Where do you go? Do you get donations, or is it, you know, or?
That's still new. So
yeah.
I tried a couple different things. It's mainly the first year has been out of pocket. It hasn't been a great financial cost. It's been a great time cost and a great energy cost.
Yeah.
But financially, you know, I'm sure $500 or $1,000 into travel and you know, office equipment and Zoom membership. And anyway, you know, for the most part, it was self-funded. I even tried to eliminate myself from different reimbursement opportunities from different tribes and organizations, so as to keep what I was doing non-biased. You know, I didn't want to be accepting money from one of the organizations for the work that I was doing if the work that I'm doing is drawing on other people's work, you know? So I'm asking organizations to submit their curriculum for organization and dissemination, but I don't want to be seen as profiting financially on somebody who's still doing a job that I can't anymore, which is sticking it out in the classroom. So, you know, it was kind of unclear at first how we would find funding. And then I was really lucky enough and super blessed. We actually just had our first convening over the past 2 days to be accepted as a Loose Indigenous Knowledge Fellow. And that was a really extremely generous and lucky acceptance into that program that's going to really help kick off the nonprofit. So, I mean, it's the financial contributions have helped already with office equipment and paperwork and legal fees, you know, things of that sort. So that's been a really nice step in the right direction as far as funding goes. And then once the 501(c) status is official, then I can start drawing upon hopefully some of my board members' individual expertise to start looking for some additional funding.
So what does the structure mean then? So you talk about board members, so Is there a certain structure to your board?
You know, it's just coming together. So I've contacted all the board and we've identified their individual positions. So I've got, I'd love to do shout outs if that's okay. I don't know if any of them will hear it, but Migas Gonzalez, she'll be our chair, and Dr. Michael Sullivan, Dr. Migas Sullivan as well, or Migas Gonzalez, Dr. Michael Sullivan. I've got Nawakwe Bill House, Bobby Tao, you know, being that this was her idea, she knows better than anybody what I'm trying to do here. And then a gentleman by the name of Tim Slekar. It was funny, we were kind of laughing about it. He says, wow, it's amazing to be the minority on the board for once, you know, because he's a Caucasian male. So but in this circumstance, he's the only non-Ojibwe partner on the board.
Wow.
Yeah. And he's an educator here at the secondary level in Wisconsin. Foundation will actually be based in Minnesota, but the head office will be here in Wisconsin, yes. Oh, wow.
Is there any specific institutions that are part of MEAN, or is there any criteria for being a part of MEAN?
That's a great question, yeah. So when I started, you know, the Ojibwe Nation is huge, right? there are so many of us and so many different reservations. What is it, 7 in Minnesota, 5 in Wisconsin?
6
in Wisconsin. Oh, I did, yeah, Mole Lake. You got 1 in North Dakota, 1 or 2 in Michigan. And then you've got so many reserves in Canada. So we're so widespread. And there are so many projects going on with language right now. I had to identify a realistic measure of who I could include in this initial contact. So what I told myself is I would only contact organizations that offer 100% immersion, not dual language, and who have been in existence and operation for the past 5 consecutive years. So I did that, and I came up with a list of 8 organizations in Minnesota and Wisconsin. Actually, 7 in Minnesota and 1 in Wisconsin. But then through those initial contacts, a couple of the program stakeholders had requested that we bring in a couple of other organizations that, you know, were kind of on the border of either full immersion or that 5-year mark, but have really put in a lot of hard work and really had a lot to offer and could benefit from this partnership. So right now we're at 11 organizations. Once again, our mutual friend, K-Cake Stark, has helped me out with some documentation legally so we can start working towards legal agreements between districts or tribes and organizations. So I think we're at 7 committed organizations as far as just a base commitment, and then 4 signed MOUs to start sharing all curriculum and materials, which will soon go on to the MEAN website, which is under construction, and that will be open to the public. So, you know, for example, Duluth Public Schools has agreed to join on, which is fantastic. So that means we can have the K-5 curriculum that they use in their school in Ojibwe immersion, combine it with, for example, Mille Lacs K-1 curriculum and pre-K curriculum, and combine that with the Niigaani curriculum. And now families at home or other communities who want to start immersion, or even other immersion communities, can now say, all right, I'm teaching a 5-year-old and it's ricing season. I have 7 different ricing units to choose from. Look at this plethora of language, books, materials, and opportunity for our community with language. And that's something that we haven't had to this point. It's been, where do I look? Who do I call? They might have something, you know? So instead of that, we'll instead have, you know, these combined efforts of 100 years and millions of dollars worth of curriculum development and personnel development and lexicon projects available for everybody. And that's the first step, right? So the first step is, what can we do right now? And that's just, you know, combining our resources. But there's more, you know, then we move on towards, what else can we combine? Professional development, field-specific conference, data tracking and recruiting, you know, teacher development. There's so much that we need as a movement that we can do so much easier if we put in some front-loading and put our heads together. And that's really the basis of MEAN, is how can we move our effort from this incredible height we've already climbed way, way higher, you know?
Right. So you mentioned, you know, Ojibwe immersion. Are you looking at other indigenous immersion programs, or to, you know, maybe target some other tribes that are in the region?
Eventually, yes. So I know Ronco and I have talked a bit about this. He says, don't forget about us. And I said, I won't, but we're busy too. You know, and I love our brothers over there. And I super want to help them. And like I said, I'm hoping that what we're trying to do here will be successful and helpful. I mean, right, that's the whole point of this. We just want to help. I've seen so many of my peers lose years with their kids, you know, because they're so busy trying to make sure that their students have something the next morning. You know, I've seen the burnout rate increase, but, you know, bottom line is a huge burnout rate in the field where we lose great educators and great speakers who just can't do it anymore because it's so exhausting and demanding. And to be able to help with any of that through this project would be an incredible service to everybody involved.
So there's a lot of exciting, you know, things going on in Indian country. When I say Indian country, I'm just specifically talking about Minnesota, Wisconsin, Great Lakes area. You know, obviously
the best Indian country.
We all have our own biases,
of
I guess.
Of course.
But you know, with obviously, and I think it's really exciting with the Midwest Indigenous Immersion Network. You know, one thing, you know, I've mentioned on a previous podcast is the, you know, is the Anjibama Dazing project over in Mille Lacs, the work that they're doing. Is that something that you're...
Yes, sir.
You're working on also?
Yes, sir. I've been very lucky to participate in the book projects there in the past several years. Worked with some really fantastic speakers and gentlemen between Obazan and Joe McWinaby. And of course, it's always great to work with peers of the same age, also second language speakers. So really fantastic project, you know, bringing in local Mille Lacs elders, letting their voices be heard, putting them in print, and making sure that their grandkids can have that, their great-grandkids can see, and, you know, really showing those elders their true worth with what they have in language and culture. That was a fantastic program. I'm still working on the Rosetta Stone project as well, which I believe is part of that Anjibama Dazing project. Mm-hmm. So I've been, once again, super lucky and so blessed professionally. I got brought on about a year ago to work with the Rosetta Stone Project as an SME, which I guess is a subject matter expert, but I don't see it that way. I see it as a guy who looks at 4,000 spreadsheets a day to write like 3 lines of practice activities. But really exciting. It's a 6-year project with 6 separate levels, all scaffolded to increase language use and comprehension in learners. And really exciting news. I actually asked my boss, said, what can I talk about in the podcast? And she said, you can't give a date, but you can say fall. So fall of 2021, you should be able to contact the Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe for the first level of Rosetta Stone Ojibwe programming.
Wow.
And level 2, I don't think we'll take another year after that, you know, because COVID really slowed things down for everybody. So, you know, after level 1 drops, I'm sure before the 12 months is up, level 2 will be ready and available. Then yearly after that until level 6.
Right. So speaking of COVID too, you know, obviously it slowed down a lot of the, you know, projects that were kind of going on in a lot of our different communities. But, you know, what's your take on COVID? Did it impact you and your efforts as far as developing MEAN, or has it been, you know, or has it not, you know, impacted you?
Globally and community-wise, it's impacted all of us so much, right? Between the losses of our speakers and community members and our absence of being able to participate in ceremony and in our general community life, it's definitely slowed down a lot of things there. As far as the week, as far as the work for starting the nonprofit, I don't know. I guess like I said earlier in the podcast, I would have preferred to start this process the Ojibwe way, right? I would have loved to take some quilts and tobacco and go to these communities and say, hey, we've got work to do. I'm willing to break my back for you. Are you in? You know, here's some gifts. Yeah. I love you. We didn't get to start that way, which, you know, wasn't preferred. But luckily, we're a small community, right? Ojibwe community is a small community sometimes. Mm-hmm. So a lot of us already have standing relationships, and we were able to go ahead and start building anyway. As far as slowing down the work, I don't think I've left my desk in like 10 years, let alone the past year or so. You know, I don't know. Something going on outside, I'm working. I have no idea.
Sometimes it's just, I'm just thinking just maybe, it's just maybe like you said, out of pocket. So, you know, sometimes it could be just travel funding or travel money, you know, gas money to get to and from certain areas. So some people, you know, I know that are working now, or have been working through COVID, that they see this virtual platform as kind of a blessing in disguise, because you're still able to meet, you don't have to travel so much, you can be in your home, you can still stay safe and not put yourself at risk. But
absolutely.
Yeah.
And you know, and that has, and maybe in retrospect, you know, maybe a few years down the road, we'll see that was actually a huge help in getting this started, you know. I mean, the basis of our programming is to bring almost a dozen separate organizations who have worked in silos, competed against each other for funding through grants, competed with each other through personnel because of our limited educated or licensed educator speaking staff, you know, to take these different organizations who are so busy and so encompassed by just keeping their community going, to make them find time to sit down at the same table with 10 other programs. Yeah, I don't know if we could have done that without everybody already sitting on their computer, you know? So, I mean, it may be that that was an opportune time to say, hey, everybody knows how to use Zoom. That's cool, you know? Everybody's already sitting at home in their computer, and I'm betting everyone can carve out an hour twice a month, you know? I was wrong on that last bet. Still working on that.
So as we kind of close up here, what's the future? What does the future look like for the Midwest Indigenous Immersion Network?
Oh, man. Big hope is in the next year. So like I said, the 501c3 should be official by fall. We're really hoping we can start applying for funding as soon as possible, start reaching out. We have a couple different organizations in mind that we're going to reach out to. And then just, you know, open calls for grants. And the big hope is sometime in the next 18 months that I can hire on a few employees. I'd really love to start a couple of those other goals of the programming beyond curriculum. So I think it'd be the best job in the world. And I would love to do it, but I'm sure someone else would love to do it even more. I want to find an employee and funding for an employee whose sole job is to track Ojibwe students in the public education system in Minnesota and Wisconsin. Identify who's receiving Ojibwe language instruction, identifying what curriculum is being used, and then start assessing and juxtaposing the effectiveness of different curricula and different methods, and start to really identify how we can reach out beyond our immersion schools into the public education sector of Ojibwe language. Beyond that, that same staff person could track those same students through, you know, their primary and secondary experience, and if they have a knack or are interested in language, help recruit them into appropriate secondary, post-secondary education options, continue to work with those same students, continue to track, and hopefully help them develop and find their ways into meaningful roles in the communities who have employment options for people who want to be working with language and culture in Ojibwe country. And then, you know, of course, we'll need more personnel for other goals as well, but that one would be my... That's the big hope, is sometime soon we can start doing that. Because I tell you, if it weren't for Sean picking me up by the nape on my neck and saying, hey, man, you have worth, and you can do something for your community, and it's going to do something for you at the same time. You know, if it weren't for someone doing that for me, forging my name on my enrollment papers, you know, I mean, I would have never went to college. I would have never seen worth in myself in this community of language revitalization, and I wouldn't be sitting here today and just thinking that we could have a full-time position of a person going out and telling kids, hey, man, you have worth, you have value, you have opportunity to be a professional Ojibwe and to do what you love. That would be so cool.
Absolutely. So so people out there listening, maybe they're inspired, you know, by your story and by the work that you're doing. How do they get a hold of you?
What's the... Oh. Not putting my cell phone.
Without disclosing any numbers. So you got a website coming up?
The website will be coming up sometime early fall. It'll be meanojibwe.org. So mean is MIIN, that's our acronym. MIINOjibwe.org. My contact information will be there. I can put all my email address. I'd be fine with that. So
well, we'll link all your information in the, when we post the podcast on the website for the extension, you know, we'll have different links on how people can get a hold of you or if different organizations want to contribute to your effort, we'll make sure that those links and those ways are available to them, so that you can get the resources and things that you need. Wonderful. All right, Miigwech Niji, appreciate your time.
Miigwech. Miigwech to Dustin Burnett for joining today's podcast. To learn more about leadership and civic engagement, go to extension.umn.edu community.com/community-development/leadership-and-civic-engagement, where you will find more resources on growing leaders and strengthening leadership. Make sure to follow the Minnesota Indigenous Leadership Network on Facebook, www.facebook.com/umn.indigenous.leadership.network, where you can view the impressive list of participants and resources of the Midwest Indigenous Immersion Network, and also to stay up to date on research and resources for tribal communities and tribal leadership. We hope that you will join us again for another episode of Indigenized Connections on Air.